Welcome to Books and Rhymes, the podcast that makes you fall in love with reading while flipping the script with a musical twist on your favorite books. I invite guests to pair a book with a song or an album that sparks the same emotional connection. I'm your host, Sarah, a West African in the diaspora with a deep abiding love for the written word. Join me on a musical journey through the works of new and classic authors. I am extremely excited to announce another live episode on the 23rd of May at Foyle's Bookshop in central London with Sarah Ladipo Maninka, who will no doubt take us on an insightful and honest discussion about her beautifully written and unforgettable novel, Independence. Tickets are available at foyles.co.uk. That's Foyles, F-O-Y-L-E-S.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. I'm so thankful for your positive feedback on last week's episode with Namwali Serpell. Subscribe to the mailing list at booksandrhymes.com for a chance to win one of two signed copies of Namwali's debut novel, The Old Rift. The winner will be announced in next week's episode. In today's episode, I'm joined by Soraya Barr, a British poet and cultural producer of Sierra Leonean descent, whose work draws on the West African tradition of storytelling. In our discussion, Soraya draws connections between Malcolm X and the work of Nas, Erykah Badu's music, and teenagers in inner city London. And she situates Lauryn Hill's work in Mariama Barr's iconic book, So Long a Letter. Tweet your thoughts on this episode using the hashtag Books and Rhymes. Follow Books and Rhymes on Twitter and Instagram. And welcome to today's episode of Books and Rhymes. Why are you laughing?
Just reminded me of like a Cheshire cat who's got the cream. Like, hello.
Welcome to Books and Rhymes, Soraya.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
And thank you for accepting my invitation to be my guest. I'm honoured and privileged that you're here.
That is no problem at all. I think your invitation left me no other option but to be a part of it. But at the same time, it is an amazing platform that you're creating, and I'm really honoured and touched that you thought my contribution would be so important. So thank you.
So my first question to you is, could you just tell me about your reading culture? Would you call yourself a reader?
Generally, everyone is a reader. Okay. But reading culture is where you get your nose stuck in a book. Like, you'd literally be quite happy and content to walk down Elephant and Castle with Charles Dickens, and you'll be content and life is good and life is well, and you're able to immerse yourself in the book and put your feet in the protagonist's shoes and go through it. And after you finish a book, you get withdrawal symptoms because you got so caught up in the story. And I think I'm a reader. I'm a reader. I love reading. And I think my journey began with reading quite late, because when I first started primary school, though I was born and bred in London, I had speech difficulty and I'm pretty sure I was dyslexic. So I had a TA personally helping me with my reading and my numeracy and literacy. So by the time I was able to independently read, I'd already had this deep interest with reading, because I like books, I like the pictures, and I wanted to understand the words and the way in which the teacher would say it to me, or the stories that my parents would read to me. I wanted to be able to have the ability to read them for myself. So by the time I was about 7 or 8, I could read independently by myself, and I started reading The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and all of the Roald Dahl books and Jacqueline Wilson, and I was hooked. Anyone in my old estate that I used to live on, they would always say, when Soraya gets sent out to play, she'll be sitting on the block reading a book or going to the shop with her book, with her nose in a book. And as time progressed, I started kind of like delving into different types of books from different cultures, different backgrounds, fiction, non-fiction, how-to manuals, started writing my own stories and my own poems as well. So reading is a very big part of my life. And I think with reading habits in general, sometimes you're reading consistently every single week, and there'll be times in life where you're so overwhelmed with what life is going on, you can't even bear to actually pick up a book. But once you're able to reignite that reading, it's just, it's a love affair, man. It is. Mm. It's a love affair.
You know, it's interesting that you say that when you were finishing, you were talking about you can get so caught up in reading that everything else disappears.
Mm.
So you're lost in the narrative, you're lost in the book. On the other hand, you can get so caught up in life that you're not able to indulge, you know? Because for me, I find that when I'm anxious, I can't read.
Can you imagine reading whilst you're anxious, like something like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and the Oompa Loompas and stuff like that, and you're anxious, and then you start thinking that you're an Oompa Loompa yourself and you're enslaved by this white man who feeds you chocolate.
Okay, when you mention it like that, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory sounds really, really problematic.
That's very trippy.
Put it like that if you want to be deep about the book itself, you know? But then you're a poet.
Yeah, I am.
And it is very clear that your early reading habit literally inspired the steps that you're on now. So could you talk about that, the evolution from reading to being a writer? Could you just touch on that and talk about your journey in that respect?
Oh, this is interesting. So I really started dabbling with writing when I was 9, and I wrote a poem for Our Mrs. Day in year 5. And it was so good that the teacher was like, you're gonna recite it to the whole school in assembly on Friday. And I was like, do you know what? I try to think about how I was on that particular day. I think when I was younger, I was a lot more bolder than I am as an adult. And I would really love to have that boldness because I was like, yeah, I'm gonna go up in assembly and recite that poem. And I did that. I did the damn thing. And it was great. Mm. From then, I started writing mini book reviews. It's like, so they'll teach us something to do in English, and then I'll just spend the whole week doing it at home in my spare time. So book review, I'd write a book review about whatever book I'm reading at the time. And then after that, it evolved from book reviews to designing my own magazine front covers and being an editor of my own magazine during my formative years. And the more I got a handle on my literacy, the more I was entered into the gifted and talented programs in primary and secondary school. So during secondary school, I used to write a lot of fan fiction. So
what kind of fan fiction?
Oh gosh, I was like a B2K fanatic. I can't believe I'm admitting that. But I was a B2K fanatic. So I would join like forums that would be like predominantly African-American girls, and then we'll log online, and then I'd have to catch up with the time zones, and then we'll submit in stories chapter by chapter. And depending on your reading, they had this thing where you'd write a chapter, and if people liked it, the more bumps you get because of the song Bump Bump Bump, bum, bum. The more bumps you got, the more you'd write. So then after that, I'll join writing collectives on these online forums. And the more I was writing, the more I started to think about, okay, I don't want a general, boy meets girl, I met him backstage, he fell in love with me out of the thousands of girls, and then we had kids called Kendra and Kyle, and we lived in like Malibu. I started to think of, okay, what if I kind of like not make him like a pop sensation? What if I was to create a character for him like he was a top politician's son, but he didn't want to follow that lifestyle. He didn't want to be straight and narrow. He probably wanted to be a creative. And there's this girl who kind of like facilitates that. What if I wrote a complete different environment that I'm not used to? So then that made me broaden up my reading patterns and my reading material. Started looking at more complex texts like War and Peace. I'm thinking War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy, Nina Karenina.
Yes.
I love Edgar Allan Poe's work.
Fabulous.
So those are just a few that I can touch on. I've read a lot of African-American literature and Black British literature as well. And though there seems to be a lot of, there's a lot of similarities in terms of kind of like the narratives, but it's also distinctly different. So even though we are the same in terms of how we may look, we are not a monolith. Some of the issues that you occur as an African American isn't, I wouldn't necessarily have that as a Black British woman. I won't be able.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
To relate.
In that same note, we're going to go on to the first book. So the first book that you want to discuss, that you picked, is your favourite book. And the title is A Society Within, written by Courtier Newland, a British writer of Caribbean descent. So could you talk about that book and why that book in particular you want to, why is that your favourite book?
Okay. Oh, right. So I remember when I first read Society Within, I joined a library, and I've got a habit of joining different libraries because sometimes I rack up a fine.
You and me both. You and me both.
And I need to just kind of like abandon that library and join a new one, a fresh start. So I remember, I think I was about 14 years old when I first read Society Within. And the first thing that grabbed me was the front cover, because I think, generally speaking, like most people, if you're trying to find a new read, the front cover has to grab you.
Yes.
I think the classics can get away with being quite drab or quite dull or nothing there, because it's like from word of mouth, you hear how great it is. There's reviews and people put it as a must read. But it's like for new books, I think it's very important that the front cover is engaging, is inviting. And sometimes Society Within, if the front cover was a bit dry, and this sounds so superficial, but I probably wouldn't pick it up.
Do you know what? You're not the only person who judges books by the covers. Anyone who knows me, if you follow Books and Rhymes on Instagram, you know we judge books by their covers. Even on Twitter, we've discussed our affinity for book covers, and we are not afraid to cuss out bad book covers. So anywho, that's a digression. But go on. You were talking about that the book cover was what attracted you
Attracted me to the book. Oh, I'm actually holding it in my hands as well. I've got this thing.
Are you excited?
Yeah, I am. It's really bad. I want to say something.
Yeah, go on.
The other day I was with my partner and we went into a bookshop, and I sniffed like the air, and then I got this shudder, and he goes, "Are you cold?" I said, "No. I smelt the smell of books and I got excited."
You had a bookgasm.
I had a bookgasm. And he just looked at me like I was crazy, and he laughed. And he's like, "Are you serious?"
Girl, I
was like,
"I feel you."
And then I picked up a book and I opened up the page and I was like, oh,
it's a good feeling.
It's such a good feeling. And for me, I don't read, because I have my iPad now, because for me, books and storage space became a problem. So I was like, okay, and when you're carrying books around in your bag, it's a bit heavy. So I was like, you know what, iPad, Kindle app and iBook pad, app, and you can have like an entire library there at the touch of your hand. So it's like, to feel it is very, it's good. So I read the blurb on the back cover, and I was like, ew, this is set on an estate in London. And to me, that was a foreign concept at the age of 14. they were teenagers. Though they were a bit older than me, I was like, okay, this is something that I can relate to. Let's take it home. And at the time, he also had another book. His first, this was, I think this was probably the second, no, this is the second novel that he wrote. The first one is a prequel to this,
okay,
called The Scholar, which coincidentally was written 20 years ago.
Oh, wow.
He first wrote that in 1997. So I took out both of the books in the series. I was like, okay, cool. Let's get started. Let's get into this. And then I'm reading it. And then I get to the dialogue. And the dialogue is like in slang. Like probably like more current at that time. But it's like they think, oh, there was one particular, they'll just be talking, oh, I was just catching at her yard. Can I come check you later? And I was like, wow. It was just mind-blowing because generally speaking, when you think of literature, you think everything has to be proper. You've got to dot the I's and cross the T's. Yep. And then you've got something I can relate to and it's very accessible for me and I can relate to it. Being a young Afro-Caribbean person in London, and though it may have been set in West London, majority of the time it conveyed themes that I relate to. I can look at any character in that book and know somebody like that. I'd have an aunt like that or a cousin like that, or I'd have a friend who has a similar family set up as that. That and the fact that I think now in hindsight, the reason why it's my favorite book is the older I got, I done radio hosting, community radio in West London, and a lot of the scenes that Caoimhe Newland described, I saw it play out. I've walked those type of streets, I've been in those type of environments. So to be able to have something that is a book, for me personally, I think it's a landmark. Can a book be a landmark?
Yeah, no, in your life, yeah. Landmark is something that actually you go back to. It's like a timestamp.
Yes, it is. I would definitely call it a timestamp in my life. And the fact that a book of that nature has impacted British culture so much, and a book of that nature where you've got a lot of people who are snobs and probably wouldn't consider this as art, or would kind of like think, oh, because it's not a Shakespeare or it's not a J.K. Rowling.
Mm. They might otherwise ignore it.
Yeah, they would ignore it, or they won't think it's very important.
We're going to now talk about the music you pair A Society Within with. I don't know why my brain just went quiet there for a moment. The song you pair it with is by Erykah Badu.
Yeah.
Didn't you know?
Yes.
Why didn't you know?
I think that particular song is kind of like a cry. God. I don't know. I don't want to come across as I'm being fake or I'm being kind of like fake woke or anything. But it just seemed as though it's like a cry of you're trying to find your way in somewhere. And it's like you're just kind of like almost going around in a maze. Because when you go around in a maze, you kind of like find a dead end, or you end up back to square one and you're like, okay, where am I? What am I doing? Where am I going? And sometimes within the society that you're in, you feel like you're in a maze. And a lot of the time within that book, there's a lot of people thinking, how did I get here? Mm. Or how do I kind of like get out of it? And or to live in that sort of environment, it's a never-ending struggle.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are, as with most books, you've got your equilibrium, disequilibrium, and a new a new equilibrium. So it may not be the same as the beginning, but it is still a change.
Mm.
And I think that song embodies all of that for me.
Mm.
And it happens to be one of my favorite songs that I always turn to when life is getting a bit too hard. And just that reassurance towards the end that love is life.
Mm.
And irrespective of what you may be going through and the pitfalls that you may embark on, there's always an end. There's always some form of a resolution. And if there isn't, then that means your story isn't over.
Mm.
And that's why I paired the two.
So when I read the book, I found the dialogue alien to me. And we had this discussion earlier on, but I found it alien because I was, and so I'm going to read like a few lines. So this is at the beginning of the book when the young people, they've just changed location. They moved into a new property because their old property caught fire. And so the mother then sends one of the young people to go to the shop and get something for them. Take this and get me some washing powder, toilet roll, some super glue from the lamp. Will a tenner be enough? More than enough, Elisha replies. You're cooking later. Veronica gives a strange look. Are you mad? I'm too tired to cook, girl. Ain't there a chippy around here or something? That's what I'm saying, innit? I seen a West Indian takeaway by that little row at shops. I can get us. Why are you laughing? Why are you laughing?
Do you know what you remind me of right now? You remind me of like a typical West African elder when they say, Ini.
Do you know what? Okay. You can see how awkward it is for me to actually, for my eyes to actually read the text. You can see, because I'm trying to think, how will this sound out loud? So this was when I was reading it at first, because the end of the words, he deliberately drops alphabets from words, like take this and get me. So instead of and, it's ands with an apostrophe, with, you know, parenthesis.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes, you cooking later. So instead of cooking with a G, he drops the G. So you cooking later. So the language is very informal. And instead of T-H-A-T for that, he writes D-A-T, that. You know, so at first I thought, do you know, like, why is he writing in this language? Because I'm thinking it's inauthentic for an adult person to write, to try and mimic young person. This is young adult fiction.
Yeah.
And there are conversations about adults writing young adult fiction. And there is this notion of inauthenticity, an older person trying to write what they think a young person sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different conversation. But for me, it was a case of, I'm not familiar with these languages because I went to an independent school, a state school nonetheless, but an independent school, an independent Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
For all intents and purposes, I didn't have your typical inner London experience. Mm-hmm. So this is not part of my lived experience. Even though I'm black, I'm in Britain, I'm African, and you can sort of contextualize me as black British, I am not black British in this respect. So when I was reading it, I had to check myself and say, why are you questioning this writing? Because it is not authentic to you, does not negate the truth in the text. So it is interesting to actually hear you say that the language is what drew you to the text. We're going to go on to your second book, which is So Long a Letter by Maria Mabar. And this is the book that has made the most impact on you.
Yes. Yes, it has. This is the book that's had the most impact on me. I read it this year, earlier on this year in February. It got someone recommended me to read it. And I kind of like joined this website where you get a subscription and you have like access to a number of texts. So I began reading it and I was hooked. It's a novella set in, I think it's 1970s or 1980s.
It's written in the 80s, but the timeline within each set is set on the cusp of independent Senegal.
So for me, it was amazing. It's a novella and it starts, it's a letter. It's a really long letter.
So long a letter.
It's so long a letter. Oh my God. It was so long a letter. The protagonist is Ramatulai. Yeah, Ramatulai Fall, because she's writing to her best friend, Asiatu Bar, which is quite funny because my mom's name is Asiatu as well.
Don't try and claim. Go on.
I'm claiming this. It's like, me, if I can even translate, that's my auntie. I will say it.
Because she's actually dope. The Asiatu is a dope character in the book. But go on.
She is. And the fact of the matter is she actually does the actions that she has, which we'll discuss further. Mm. It reminds me of my mum's character and what unfolds within the book. So Ramatulai, she's recently lost her husband and she's currently undergoing Idada. And that, I probably pronounced that very wrong, but that's the Arabic for a Muslim process of a widow. So when a Muslim woman loses her husband, she has to go through mourning for 4 months and 10 days. So during that period of time, she's talking about, she's writing a letter to her friend Asiatu Bar, who doesn't live in Senegal anymore. She's migrated for economical reasons and other reasons, which we will discuss further. But she's lost her husband, and she's also talking about how she's coping with dealing with her co-wife. He's her late husband's second much younger younger wife. Well, she's young enough to be his daughter, but his second wife. And she's talking about how she's dealing with that, how Senegal is changing, how she's coping with life as a woman, as a mother, as a widower who also works as a teacher.
In keeping with the theme of books and rhymes, you paired So Long a Letter with The Passion by Lauryn Hill. And I think the lyrics, before you talk about this song, I think the lyrics are apt. The lyrics, the song, it's like a lament. She's lamenting.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
A song. She's lamenting love, Lauryn Hill is, in this song. And the lyrics are very repetitive. It's literally repetitive lyrics. The sound is somber. The sound kind of draws you in. You feel her pain. You feel her hurt in the song. So could you tell me, why did you feel the need to connect this particular song with So Long a Letter?
I think even though it was written from the point of view of women, their decisions ultimately and the cause for the discourse or the letter was related to men. And they've caused all this destruction around them. The men have created all this destruction without them with, well, some would say, oh, they're having their cake and I think we had that conversation. It's like they are having their cake and eating it. But as the story unfolds, you'll find that the men themselves, even though they made their decisions very with their eyes open, they walked into it very comfortable. They didn't even walk into it, they bopped into it like with a lean in their step. And they still suffered as well. So the men suffered. Other people say good, but they did suffer ultimately. And literally, Lauryn Hill says, if you only knew love like this before. So it's like, it's just taking that emphasis on the notion of love. And if you truly love somebody, you wouldn't put them through what they are going through. And even some of the decisions that the women would make for themselves, if they knew the love of themselves, would their decisions have changed? If they loved themselves a lot more than how I probably would perceive some of their decision making to be a lack of self-love, if they loved themselves more, how would the story have gone? How would it unfold? Because again, this is just Marima Barr is taking her lived experiences, whether she lived for it directly or she's living them vicariously through stories that she may know, or scenarios that has happened within her life that's impacted her to write a novella of this nature. If there was enough love in the world or within that society, would it change? Because a lot of women are affected by polygamous relationships. Mm. And sometimes it's a case of where it's a clear indication that their spouse is more in love with wife number three and probably mistreats wife number four, but kind of like picked her up along the way for whatever social standing you may have or whatever lust that you may have. Or maybe wife number one can't produce a son for you. Mm. So you marry somebody else, but you don't think about how that would have a psychological effect on that woman. And within the story as well, they don't just focus on the main protagonist. They give other examples of other women who have they've bore the brunt of a polygamous relationship. And it's just kind of like a lament of, if we were to love, human beings in general, were to love the way in which, like purely without any kind of like agenda behind it, if you were to love people purely, what a world would it be?
I'm now going to ask you about your relation with the book, because this is about your relationship. I know you're passionate about the story.
Yes.
I know. You're passionate about it. And it's a really good book.
Even Ramatulai's own. But that can be kind of like deconstructed.
Yes.
We can talk about this all night.
This book, it's a topic on its own, but let's talk about your relationship with it. So, Marema Barr is an African woman grappling with a society that is increasingly moving from the traditional to Western lifestyle and Western ideals. Mm-hmm. Do you identify with these tensions? You know, especially when I say, do you identify, I mean, you are a Sierra Leonean woman with, you know, Sierra Leonean parents. Your parents were they first generation migrants? They've come over here from Sierra Leone.
First generation migrants. Yeah. So I'm first generation British Sierra Leonean.
There you go. So you're born here and they are from home, from Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. So it's that thing of you being a child born in the West and they being parents from the continent. Mm-hmm. So are these tensions between the old and the new, are they reflected in your lived experiences? And if they are, if you have identified points in which there are similarities in that, how did you navigate them and how did you circumvent these tensions?
So my lived experiences is probably different to a lot of my peers who have economic migrant parents, because my mom came here when she was quite young. She was 9 years old. My dad came over here in his teens. But even though they have an understanding of British culture, a lot of the time I grew up thinking that when I'm within my four walls, I'm in Sierra Leone. Mm. So a lot of things that will probably be a bit foreign to my English peers is that as a girl child, I need to know by the age of 10 how to cook, how to clean, assisting my mother in those sort of roles. And there was a big emphasis on education, because education in Africa is a luxury, as sad as it is to say. What I found within reading So Long a Letter, because both female leads, Ramatalai and Asiatu, they both have children. But there was more of a focus on Asiatu raising her children. And I guess she was facing the same struggles that my mother would have done. I think she's got twin daughters, and one of them, I think one or both of them had kind of like discovered smoking at some point.
That's Ramatalai.
Ramatalai, yeah. So she, so things that occur in my youth, because I discovered smoking at a young age when you're not supposed to, you know, you experiment and oh god, my dad will murder me.
But well, you're older now.
I know. But it's quite, I found it quite fascinating that I'd always had this perception in Africa that everything was really strict. For me, getting sent back home was a punishment because you'll get on the straight and narrow. But I'm reading this book at this age and I'm like, they were doing the same thing I was doing here. The issues are kind of like parallel, but it's just the setting is completely different.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
With regards to kind of like the struggle between the old and the new, there are some traditions that my parents have or perceive me to achieve where I'm like, I don't want to do that. But I guess it's because of the time that I'm in as well. We're going through a digital age. And I guess in a way, the way So Long a Letter is written, they're going through a revolution themselves. And times are changing. Ramatalai through Maramabar, she's got this distinct way of Ramatalai relaying to Asia to the changes within Senegal from what they remember it to be. So it was a very beautiful book that unpackaged a central theme of change. And I guess we as a people, whether you're living on the continent or part of the diaspora, you're always constantly going through this change, and there will always be a struggle, because it's like, as a parent, you have one experience, and then when you have your offspring, it's not the same. Even with the whole notion of the second wives, as a Muslim woman, realistically speaking, if my husband wanted to marry a second wife, he can do that.
Would you accept it though? Because that's a $1 million question.
Well, this is why I say this book has had such a big impact on me, because at the time I was seriously considering marriage. If in African standards, I'm well over the hill, you know, I need to be married fast, quick. So at the time of reading it, I'd already had conversations with married girlfriends, girlfriends who may be looking, girlfriends who are staunchly saying, I'm just focusing on me right now. If he comes, he comes. If he doesn't, he doesn't. But reading that book and having to deal, like seeing how other women are dealing with being the first wife or being the second wife, I was like, that's not my portion. And within my culture in general, there are people who do have second wives. I've got family members back home who are in polygamous relationships.
Yeah.
That's not my portion. And again, some people can say, oh, that's down to culture, what you're exposed to. But there's a lot of people back home or historically that don't have it. And again, it depends on sometimes it's clear as well within the book that religion and culture, often the lines blur. And sometimes people use religion, but they kind of like package it in a way that is of their benefit.
Yeah.
And it's not really kind of like following the religious practice to a T, because a lot of the things that were happening and the way in which these men were acquiring their second wives was very detrimental. And you have two characters who have the same situation happen to them, and they react completely differently.
And
they're of the same time frame.
Yeah.
And they are best friends as well.
Yeah.
So usually you think, oh, you're my girl. You're my sister. If we are like besties, we're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
If something happens to me, you're going to react the same way. But they act completely differently.
In that vein, it's that thing about what constitutes feminism. Is feminism literally you saying that I'm going to disrupt the status quo? Or is it you actually saying I'm going to ride the storm, ride the wave? And for me, the way I interpreted it through this text was, to thine own self be true.
For me, I'm actually upon your recommendation and your such reliable sources, I'm starting to read up on feminism, purely because, one, I'm not going to lie, I've been a bit ignorant around that topic. And there's a lot of questions and a lot of conversations that happen around it that I would love to be able to put my input in. But I want it to come from a place of knowledge and not just kind of like my own notions and then tutus, I'm shot down and I don't have no clap back to give. But when you mention the two extremes about, okay, I'm not tolerating this and it's destructive and very revolutionary, or you've got, I'm just going to ride out the storm. For me, I just think of the principles of Islam. Because realistically speaking, if somebody does an injustice to you, you as a Muslim, you have a right to get your revenge. At the same time, it's recommended for you to try and forgive and overlook it and try and overcome it on a more kind of like, some people will call it a more docile way, but it's a more peaceful way because it's less destructive to those who are directly affected by it. One of the characters' decisions to stop laughing at me. Stop it. Do you now understand why I said that this is the book that gets to me?
No spoilers.
Do you know what? I didn't even give no spoilers about Society Within, and that's like my favorite book.
This one hits the spot.
I
don't think you realize the impact this book has on you. This book touches your core.
Yes.
This is the kind of book that you read, because I read it. You know, because I wasn't able to get it from the library, and I, you know, if I'd ordered it, it'd take too long to come.
I think, so I read realistically speaking, it's a text that isn't very popular. It's only if you know. There's a lot of people I've spoken to about it, and because they had their education on the continent, they're like, yeah, I've read that book. But over here, and maybe because it was written in French and then translated into English, it's probably not accessible. So maybe somebody who had done schooling in France, or they had access to it. But over here, Marima Barr is like, even when the person introduced me to her as an author, I was like, no, I've not heard of her. But now I'm just so happy that I was able to, this book has changed my life. And the reason why I say that is because one of the main characters, based on her decision, comes into conflict with her family members because of her decision. And again, that has the conflict between the old and the new, and the generational kind of like tug of war, if you will, because she's made a decision. And for me, a lot of people may see it as weak, but for me, when I was reading it, I saw it as a woman who was in love.
Mm.
And though she's faced the utmost betrayal by this man that she loved, she was willing to still kind of like abide by that covenant that she made with God. Mm. That is heartbreaking. That was heartbreaking.
So another thing that I got from this is, no matter what decisions you make, there are no decision is easy.
No, it's repercussions. Never easy.
And not just repercussions, but whatever path you choose, there are going to be bumps on the road.
Mm.
There are going to be, nothing is ever easy in life, but be justified in every decision that you make. Make sure it is true to you. And don't live your life for other people. But that's me, just me. I don't want to say what I want to say, but yeah, don't live your life for other people.
Don't now, at all. Didn't realize how much So Long a Letter impacted me, because I've not really had to talk about it. Not many people, even if I've spoken about it, I'll be like, it's a great book, left it at that, kept it moving, but I've not gone into it. So now I'm going into it and I'm like, wow.
The book was good. You selected the autobiography of Malcolm X as your your third book.
Yeah.
More specifically, it's mm-hmm. your go-to book.
That's my go-to book.
So define go-to. What is go-to in this context? And how does Malcolm X fit into your definition of go-to?
I think people who inspire you, you should always review their story. Review where they're coming from, what they've been through, what they've accomplished, and as much as you can, try and get inside of their mind. Mm. So you would read interviews or read their articles, watch video footage of them, observe their work. And for me, Malcolm X's autobiography is my go-to to gain inspiration.
You chose to pair the autobiography of Malcolm X with Nas' It Ain't Hard to Tell.
Yeah.
What is the connection between Nas and Malcolm X?
I'm just going to put this out there. I decided to kind of like be a geek and write little notes for myself. And Sarah's like, no, this is authentic. Books and rhymes is authentic. Leave your book. But I just kind of,
she's
like,
gonna read her notes now.
No, I'm not reading my notes. These are the actual lyrics that I think kind of like pair the two together. But Malcolm X, though he was born in Nebraska, and he's kind of, his life got scattered around most of kind of like the Midwest and the American South. Prior to him embracing Islam, when you think Malcolm X, you instantly think New York. Nas is very New York. New York is very gritty. A lot of the time, Nas's lyrics has allusions to Islam. This particular song, I think there may be some Islamic references, but not many. But it's just like the wordplay. Nas is very, I'm a secret hip hop head, but Nas's flow is sick and his wordplay is second to none in my opinion. He is the best.
He's a lyricist. He's an amazing lyricist.
He is. And then when he's rapping, I think Malcolm X, you are inspired by Malcolm X, because it's like when you hear the way in which Malcolm X speaks, I'm such a geek. Sometimes I will just go on YouTube and watch a Malcolm X speech, because the way in which he conveys it is almost as if he is rapping.
Mm.
And he just does it. He conveys his messages with finesse. And he schools people. And there's a particular line in Ain't Hard to Tell where Nas says, "School of all well, you feel it like Braille." Get like literally, it's like you're blind, but you still see by force.
Yes.
And literally, that is just kind of like it's very synonymous to Malcolm X's story, because it's like some of the lyrical content within that particular song, it refers to I'll use the term loosely with quotation, unsavory things. So he talks about smoking weed a lot in it, and acting up and things that are connected to the street.
It's talking
and
about that his life.
And that's very much Malcolm X, because Malcolm X wasn't always five times a day praying, has his Betty and his children, and uplifting the black woman and talking about the black woman's plight in America, being the most unprotected and most unloved and most endangered person in America. Mm. Before he was in a relationship with a white woman.
Mm.
And he used to relax his hair. Back then they called it conking. Mm. And coincidentally, whilst he got arrested, the police actually cut off his water supply, so he still had the conk in the film and in the book as well. So he eventually had to wash his hair in the toilet water because it was burning his scalp. So in a way, he was quite lost. And sometimes within that, you're always kind of like on a tightrope. Well, I find myself in a tightrope where you're trying to follow a straight path, but the ratchet in you just keeps coming out, you know. And not saying that Malcolm X is ratchet in no way, shape or form, but his past life was very much what we would deem to be of somebody who was battling their own internal demons, but there was no kind of like guideline or to keep them in constraints, so they were just wiling out. And through his imprisonment, he was then able to be introduced to a form of Islam. And as he progressed, and I like to say, use the term elevation. I don't like evolution, because evolution means you're changing completely.
Mm.
Elevation means you remain the same as you have always been, but you're just ascending to higher heights. Mm. And realistically speaking, Malcolm, as I mentioned before, from the beginning, he's always been himself. He's just he's elevated to higher heights. Mm. And that's why I think of Nas, because Nas, with his work and his body of work, he always elevates.
Malcolm X went through different changes, different transformations in his life. People remember him now as the ultimate freedom fighter, the one who speaks for the oppressed. Mm-hmm. But in truth, he was a pariah.
Yes.
At the time when he was alive, he was a pariah by the media.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, even within the black community, the African-American community that he was advocating for, he was a pariah.
Because he did what a lot of people were scared to death of doing. He was the megaphone, not even the voice, the mouthpiece. He was the megaphone of expressing the extent of what white oppression does to black people. I understand that a lot of people are either pro Malcolm or pro Martin. For me, they're one in the same. They are literally yin and yang.
In that same vein, there is a scholar called James H. Cone. He started his theory, which I'm just like, why did it take so long for someone to come up with this concept?
Mm-hmm.
His theory is called Black Liberation Theology.
Okay.
So he was a theologian in America, and he was very much pro-black power and everything. He was studying, he was doing his PhD in theology, and he realized that, you know, he saw a lot of parallels in the Christian text, parallels between the black, the African-American lived experience in America and the sufferings depicted in the Bible.
Mm.
And then he found the disparity between how those sufferings in the Bible are being interpreted by the white establishment.
Yeah.
And how those sufferings are being used to further oppress black people, instead of actually saying that, no, actually, we are oppressing you and we are misappropriating the scriptures to oppress people.
We're saying this is God.
Yeah, like basically saying that. Because they use
and
the Bible.
And this is your portion.
Because there is slavery was justified based on the theory that black people are the sons, descendants of the sons of Ham. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know this, but in the Bible, Noah.
Oh yeah,
who,
I do.
You know the yeah. For
I'm
in
very
case
familiar
I,
with
in
this
case our listeners are not familiar, okay. But in the Bible, I don't know if they have the same story in Islam.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Bible, Noah, the story of Noah, the earth was going to be destroyed because of man's wickedness, and therefore Noah was tasked with saving mankind, mm-hmm. right? And so after mankind was saved, Noah had no, was it, is it Noah? Yeah.
Yes, it's Noah. Because Noah had Ham, Shem, and Japheth.
There you go. So Noah had three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, like you said. So one day Noah got really drunk. He got so drunk that he lost his inhibitions, and then the son saw him naked. Ham saw him naked, and Ham went to tell his siblings, mm-hmm. and the siblings came and saw the father naked. And I think it was Japheth that actually got the cloth
and covered him.
Mm-hmm. And Noah then realized this incident, and he then cursed Ham, and he said to Ham that you would tow the fields, and your generations and your generations and your generations would continuously tow the fields. Now the enslavers interpreted this. They misappropriated this by saying that black people are the sons of Ham because we're black.
Mm.
Our skin is black. Literally meaning that because Noah cursed Ham to say that you're going to toil the fields, ergo, black people became black because they were always toiling the fields. They were always out in the sun. Therefore, it is in your DNA to go and pick cotton in the fields.
See, now that's a different theory, because I've always heard of the story that black people are descendants of Cain, because after Cain murdered Abel, he was sent to wander the earth aimlessly.
Mm. And therefore black people are meant to be diaspora and scattered all around the earth.
Exactly, and we're quite aimless. So that is a new theory.
This is the theory that was used, that was the linchpin of American slavery.
That's interesting.
Yeah, this was a linchpin because it was basically you're meant to till the earth.
Mm.
Black people are tilling the earth. They're always out. They're subhuman. So basically you do not qualify for the grace of God. You do not qualify for the glory of God. You do not qualify for grace or glory. And it, which goes back to this,
that's really damaging.
It's, you know, which goes back to this myth. So if you look at literary theories, and if you look at the themes and motifs of Victorian literature, like Jane Eyre and co, you find that there is this, the motifs of whiteness being linked with angels.
Yeah.
Whiteness being linked with lightness, and lightness being equated with, good.
Mm-hmm.
And blackness being equated with evil.
And
anywho, now,
yeah.
Exactly. So going back to James
and
H. Cone.
Sorry.
You're just quoting everything now, aren't you? So going back to James H. Cone, he then saw this thing, this connection
mm-hmm.
between white supremacy or the subjugation of black people and the sufferings of the Israelites in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And the sufferings of Israelites in the Bible. And it was actually saying that, actually, hold on. What we have been taught is false.
Yeah.
The theology that we're being taught is false, because he realized that this is not being discussed. And so him being in the establishment, being a black person, predominantly white environment, coming up with this theory and realizing that there's no one supporting him, it was then upon him to go and study this even further.
Mm.
I mention him because he wrote a book about Malcolm and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King,
mm-hmm.
and literally saying that they're two sides of the same coin.
Yes.
where Malcolm X was advocating, because Malcolm X was the precursor to the Black Panther Party. People mm-hmm. don't realize he was a precursor to Black Panther Party.
Oh, yeah, he was.
And Martin Luther King was also the precursor for the SNCC, the students, the nonviolent protest.
Mm-hmm.
And Martin Luther King was for dialogue, was all about dialogue. And Malcolm X was like, no, there is no room for dialogue. You've done too much damage. So he was basically saying that both are two extreme sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be too acquiescent and you can't be fighting all the time. You need both the yin and the yang to work together.
You do. And I think towards the latter part of Malcolm X's life,
yes.
More so when he, which he goes on to relate in his autobiography, when he decided to leave the Nation of Islam, and the way in which he left was, as he describes, under great betrayal by somebody who introduced him into Islam and welcomed him and kind of like gave him the platform to do his preaching and reach the level in which he had. He was at a loss, and again, going through another state of evolution within himself.
So Malcolm X, discovery of books, changed his life and trajectory. And I want to know if I want to know if you can speak on the impact of literature, books and reading on your sense of self and your sense of identity.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of books do you choose to read? Because so far you've picked a book about the development of self, a book about people who are in between cultures, marginalized characters.
Mm-hmm.
You've picked a book by a Muslim woman in the continent of in Africa, in Senegal. Mm-hmm. And now you've picked a book by a radical freedom fighter in America. So your reading is varied and the things you read about are varied.
Mm-hmm.
So how do books and how do reading impact you, impact your output and impact how you see the world and how you relate to people who are different from you and also in the world?
Okay. For me, I think my relationship with books is pretty much the same with how Malcolm rediscovered the art of reading whilst he was in prison. And in the beginning of his autobiography, he explains how he was a very bright child and how the comments of a teacher then kind of like made him flip his middle finger and says, well, if that's what you think of me, I'm going to basically go against the school system. But he started off by being instructed to read the dictionary from A to Z, which that's something I've never done. But from that within itself, kind of like reading every word in the dictionary and finding out that and reading the definition as well, and then accelerating your reading to a level. And when you're in prison, you've got all the time in the world to read, to be honest. But for me, I think once that exercise opened a floodgate, and for me, when I was able to finally kind of like read unassisted, that opened a floodgate for me. It got to a point where I could read a 300 page book within 48 hours. I've gone a bit lazy now because I don't have the luxury of reading to my leisure as I did when I was a child, or when I was much younger than I am now. But it opened a floodgate, and I guess I don't want to say my life mirrors Malcolm X, because what he's accomplished in life, I've not even done a fraction of it. But it inspires me to do the people have described it as activism. I just feel as though I'm just doing what I'm supposed to, what is obliged to me as an individual who kind of like ticks every diversity box. I'm a Black Muslim woman. I'm an artist, I'm a reader, I'm a mother, I'm everything that is kind of like looked down upon or not so deemed.
So you're literally on the margin of society. Every margin imaginable, you're there.
I'm there. I'm first generation. My parents are migrants. Though economic migrants, they are migrants all the same. You see how the media depicts migrants to be. I tick every single box. So for me to create platforms such as the Black and Muslim in Britain web series and the screening that we held at Birkbeck University, which Marcus Garvey actually studied at, for me, it's so humbling that I'm able to carry out events of that nature and have it covered by publications such as BuzzFeed, OK Africa. There are so many other publications, but it's like literally just my mind has gone blank.
Could you speak more on the Black in Britain project?
Yeah.
And what were your inspiration for it?
Mm-hmm.
And how have you been and how were you inspired to undertake it?
So the Black and Muslim in Britain project, I'm not the brainchild of it. It's not my baby, but it is. I'm kind of like, I'm like the enthusiastic auntie. Mohammed Mohammed and Sakina Lenoir, they are young creatives and activists who identify as Black and Muslim, but we're all from different backgrounds. So they initially decided to embark on this project where it's a simple concept. You've got a camera facing a group, an individual or a couple, and they're presented with a series of questions that they've got the floor to answer as candidly as possible. And then that is then packaged into a YouTube video. So a question could be, what's the strangest thing you've heard as a Black Muslim? And then that person can then unpackage it by saying the comments and how it made them feel, and maybe just some friendly advice on what not to ask. And the reason why is because what you find as a Black Muslim person living in Britain, you are left out of a conversation all the time. So it's like too Black to be Muslim, too Muslim to be Black. If we go to a pan-African setting and they start talking about issues, you will hardly see somebody who is visibly Muslim speaking about those issues, or we're not associated with it because everybody has their own preconceptions related to religion and the plight of Black people. If you go to a Muslim setting, the anti-Blackness within the Muslim community is extremely rife. And I guess it's a case of where we wanted to be able to discuss that, where you don't have to worry about offending anybody. You're just being truthful about it. You're being as respectful as possible, but you're just stating your truth and your lived experience. And you're given that platform to speak about your issues for yourself. Again, just kind of like taking ownership of your own narrative and not having to rely on other platforms, because a lot of the time we Black Muslims, or more so than ever, talk about the disparity within the Muslim narrative. How when you think about a Muslim person, you're looking at an Asian or an Arab, and our existence are completely different, but you will never really see a Black representative. So that was created, and it's gotten quite a bit of a buzz, if I'm to be totally honest. And
it was, I knew about it and I was very excited about it. And I remember speaking to Wasi and I was like, I'm so upset I couldn't make it because I had a conflicting event that day. Cause I was like, I would have loved to be there, cause I know you. And I also know some of the organizers, like Mohammed, come on, we go, you
know. Everybody knows Mohammed, like, it's amazing, mashallah. I'm just so grateful that I was able to be a co-producer. I learned a lot about myself. I felt like I was back in university again, because during university I was a media student. We organized these type of projects quite often, so it felt really good to kind of like be back in production. But also working towards something that is beneficial for the wider community and not just something for me to kind of like put down on my LinkedIn profile to endorse me. Do you know what I mean?
I think that's one thing that I absolutely love about the movement now. When I say the movement, I mean there seems to be this move where everyone is doing something for the greater benefit of everyone else, and everyone is doing it due to an innate desire to effect change. Wow. On that note, thank you so much, Soraya, for
being such
a wonderful guest on Books and Rhymes.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I'm really, literally, I'm so touched that you invited me, sincerely. And this is just the beginning of something really dope.
Soraya Barr is an entire mood. Her honest engagement with literature is inspiring. Listen to her poetry and find out more about her works on sorayabarr.com. That's sorayabarr.com. The details are in the show notes. As stated earlier, I am excited to announce that I will be hosting another live episode of Books and Rhymes, the podcast, on Thursday, 23rd of May at the iconic Foyles Bookshop in Charing Cross with Saradadipo Manyinga, author of Independence. Go to foyles.co.uk to get your ticket. The link to the ticket is in the show notes. Tune in to next week's episode with Oyekan Braithwaite, author of My Sister the Serial Killer, a novel that was recently shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction, as we discuss her strategies for coping with criticisms, the importance of being grounded in faith, and the eccentricities of being a Nigerian. An extended playlist of songs featured in this and future episodes are available in the show notes. The song you have just heard is titled Dismembered by Mia Kuhn. If you enjoyed this episode, do me a favour and subscribe, rate and review Books and Rhymes on iTunes and your favourite podcast listening platforms. Tell your friends about the podcast and continue the conversations by following Books and Rhymes on Twitter and Instagram. That's at Books and Rhymes on Twitter and Instagram. Have a great week and see you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.